spins.
Okay. So I have some alternative titles up there for you. And I guess I will try to explain as we go along what that means. Yes, this interfaces very nicely with the last two talks, and I think that my goal here was to try to see what observations can tell us about these problems of kick and, as it turns out, as a consequence, spin. So let me spend a little bit of time here doing some introduction. First of all, most of you know this, but let's remind you that the kicks, they're large and they're ubiquitous. We find virtually all neutron stars show some evidence of kick. But the thing I'm going to focus on here is the idea that we've got a couple kinematic fossils of the dynamic event that caused these kicks. The linear and angular momenta are both something that are in principle measurable today, and we should use that information to go back and figure out what's going on with the kicks. There's some differences in the predictions for those two momenta in different scenarios, and probably what's driving this little effort that my group is doing now is that some new technology has made now, for the first time, some of these fossils observable. Okay. I'll tell you, though, as we've done some modeling of the kick-induced spin and the kick of the pulsar, the correlations in these observables are surprisingly complex. But there are some results from initial measurements, and I'll tell you what we've been able to do. And just as a sort of the bottom line is that and I was very interested to hear the talks this morning, which seemed to motivate this yet further, but the initial measurements suggest that you've got to get a torque out of the kick as well. And further, that the time scale for the kick is not instantaneous, that there's some sort of slight delay, and that seconds are the relevant time scale in the problem. Okay? So, just a basic reminder, we know that they're high-velocity objects, we've known this for a long time, and that the parent population is substantially lower velocity. The Guitar Nebula, I guess, is still the poster child for this game, but we believe that velocities get up to several thousand kilometers a second. You know, this is a lot of energy. It's a large fraction. Now, pulsar binaries also tell you a lot about kicks, and in the interest of trying to tell you something new today, I am not going to talk very much about the binary information. Philip could fill you in on more on this if you're interested, but certainly binary survival, geodetic precession, you can infer a lot about the kicks of the pulsars within binaries. Fairly complicated story. But I think a nice recent bit of progress is that now there are secure purely astrometric measurements, i.e. parallaxes and proper motions that together just give you large speeds. So velocities larger than 1,000 kilometers a second are now inevitable, are needed in any viable model. So here's the key issue, and I think this is what we're all excited about. How do you get such a large fraction of the rest mass into bulk kinetic motion? That's what makes this an exciting game. Well, okay, a little bit of history. You've got to go back, of course, to the old days, and the Blau mechanism is the one way that people talked about in the early days of getting a velocity. But as we've heard, it's very tough to get out much more than a few hundred kilometers a second. However, there is an interesting prediction for the component of the velocity that comes from the Blau mechanism. Of course, it's got to be orthogonal to the original orbital plane. Does that have something to do with the spin angular momenta of the stars? Yes, for the progenitors in close binaries. Perhaps not, as I'll suggest, for the final products. The second place people talked about getting out this bulk kinetic energy is from the spin energy. And I guess it's kind of interesting, historically, the Harrison-Tatamaro rocket was one of the earliest proposals. Getting this game to work, though, requires really very short initial spin periods, a few milliseconds to get us up to the velocities that we see. One nice thing about this is that it has a very long time scale, the spin down time, and there's a clear prediction that whatever momentum you get will be along the spin axis. And finally, and I think this is where the real game is, you've got to directly probe the gravitational energy of the incoming collapse. And there are many versions of this, which some of that were discussed this morning. Dong Lai has also talked about several versions. Convective instabilities, of course, within both the core and the gain radius. And there, the characteristic timescales are tens to hundreds of milliseconds. And the direction is almost certainly random, although it may be imposed by rotation of the progenitor or the magnetic field. Accretion asymmetries, as were discussed a little bit this morning, I think that's really exciting. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. And finally, there's a kind of sexy, you know, but maybe not completely implausible idea that the underlying neutrino flux may have an imparted asymmetry. Unfortunately, these sort of scenarios generally impose something pretty exotic in the way of magnetic fields, even in this magnetar era that we live in today. One nice thing about these predictions is that there is there's a relatively long time scale for neutrino-driven things. So the point I'm trying to make in this talk, I guess you want to take one thing home, is that at least in principle, we should be able to measure the linear and angular momenta and get something out of the vector parts of the study. So we are assuming here that the spin vector of the neutron stars is fixed after the heat and light of the supernova are gone. Of course, it will be spinning down, but precession, at most, will just dither it around a mean axis. And I'm going to focus here on this talk on the young single neutron stars. There is indeed still information from binaries, but I suspect it's much less than we have assumed in the past. Technology. I wanted to mention that there's been some progress in observations that have really pushed us ahead quite a bit. And we've been working quite a bit with Walter Briskin over at NRAO, and he's been helping us a lot with doing some proper motion studies. And it's really remarkable how far these things have come in the last few years. In two fronts. Well, pulsar timing, for those of you who aren't involved in that game, has really made some interesting progress. For long timing databases, Hobbs and his colleagues have now shown that with careful filtering, you actually can get reliable timing proper motions out for young, not too young stars, stars that are not too noisy in their spin rotation. Now, for relatively bright, and that means more than a few millijanskies, interferometry has made amazing progress as well. And Shami Chatterjee and Steve Thorsett and Walter Briskin and others have really developed this to the point where we can now get reliable proper motions and parallaxes in many cases for objects that are down to a few millijansky. And the VLBA, of course, is a great, great advance there, and the high sensitivity array in a few cases. There's a handful of young pulsars which have enough sufficient optical emission, and you can do the game optically. But after you run out of the real kinematic proper motions, sometimes we're forced to fall back on some of the old standbys. There's information in radio scintillation. Unfortunately, it's only 1D. It's basically a pattern speed. And, well, sometimes you even have to go all the way back to inferring a burst site and looking at the offset from there. But then, when you do that, you deserve what you get. Okay, angular momentum measurements. This is tough as well. Of course, traditionally in the rotating vector model, as you go right across the magnetic pole, the polarization sweep, the position of the maximum of that polarization sweep is supposed to be the position axis of the rotation on the plane of the sky. This is highly phenomenological stuff, and I basically was writing it off for years. There's a very nice recent paper by Simon Johnston and his colleagues that have really tried to be as systematic as they could, and I'd say it looks, well, hopeful. I think there's some interesting information, and in some cases you can really, with a careful work, and even then, though, there's 90-degree ambiguities, there's mode flips, and this is one of the cleanest pulsars, it's very difficult to figure out the phase and then the position angle of the maximum of that sweep, but they claim it can be done. When they do so, by the way, interestingly, they claim that there's a good correlation between the direction when they have a proper motion and the direction of that spin axis. Interesting. There's another more recent paper by Dong Lai and a couple colleagues, and they have tried to play the same game. I just want to comment, they seem to adopt rather credulously almost anything in the literature, so I would be a little more circumspect. Here's the tack that we've been taking recently. And that is that in the cases where you see a pleurion around the pulsar, it has now become obvious in at least several cases that there is axial symmetry. There's toroidal symmetry, and let's face it, that toroidal symmetry must reflect the spin axis. What's even more interesting about this, for some of the stuff that I've been involved in, I mean, I'm interested in the physics of the PWN themselves, but it also turns out to be very valuable for us to figure out the inclination because we want to use these to study the viewing angle of the pulsar to interpret the high energy gamma ray emission. But for our present exercise, we're just going to be interested in looking at the position angle of that symmetry axis on the plane of the sky. Here's the famous first two examples, Crabbe and Vela. And I think almost any reasonable person would say that you can actually at least draw this axis of symmetry in the problem. That's what the game is here. And even if the fine details of the sort of fitting that we've been doing to the pulsar wind nebulae don't convince you, I think the symmetry axis, which is the most robust result of these fits, is almost impossible to avoid. So here's the kind of model that we've been applying, and primarily to Chandra data. The idea here is that you have a torus, perhaps in some cases two tori, north and south of the spin equator, and then axial jets. Now these are relativistic outflows, and Doppler boosting is going to guarantee that the near side of the tori will be relatively bright, and the near side of the jet. So there's a general pattern. You get a bright emission on the limb of the torus on one side, and then a relatively bright emission from the jet, the forward pointing jet on the other. So you go ahead and do this model, fit some parameters. What we found is that you can actually get quite a bit out of, well, not very impressive Chandra data. Of course, there are some objects that are really impressive. Crabbe and Vela, here is the data, here is the fit models. And I think you range from obvious torus and or jet to, well, pretty likely, pretty plausible torus and jets. And then you get down to the bottom line here, and it takes a true believer, I think, to really be convinced you're seeing something. But the point is that the statistical errors, this method we developed, give you statistical errors on these parameters, and that's quite useful. So now we can make measurements of the symmetry and the orientation angles and quantify the uncertainty in them. It's not quite dark enough. Well, here's an example of one of those guys that was really not quite believable. We managed to get 100 kilosecond exposure, and I don't know if it's dark enough. You see there's nice narrow jets coming off the center of this thing. Here's a energy-coded Chandra image of the core. The pulsar, which is quite soft, is in the center. Here's the little torus, and you can see the jets. I guess with the model, you can see a little bit better. A little torus and then some jet axes. Well, you go, that's kind of difficult to swallow all the details, but the axis of symmetry is extraordinarily well measured. And indeed, we know this axis of symmetry to a few tenths of a degree. That's the game that's played here. So what are you going to do with this axis of symmetry? Well, let's look a little bit of history in this game. Crabb and Vela, as soon as these images came out and people noticed there was axis of symmetry, of course, people did the sensible thing, compared it with other axes in the problem. Caraveo and Mignani took a look at some HST data of the crab and made an initial estimate of the proper motion and claimed that it was with 3 degrees, plus or minus 10 degrees, from the axis of symmetry of the nebula. The same group took a look at Vela and said it was 0, plus or minus 3 degrees, from the axis of symmetry of the nebula. Well, okay, radio interferometry has managed to measure the actual proper motion of Vela with somewhat higher precision, and it's in this case significantly off, although generally aligned. First, you've got to ask yourself, now we only got two objects. The alignment is, well, claimed alignment's pretty high, but the actual alignment's not perfect. Is this just chance? I mean, is there something significant going on there? And if you do the statistics, the two-dimensional projection has a, depending on which of these numbers you adopt, a 1 to 3% probability. This is not quite enough to bet even your goldfish on. But it's enough to get you interested and say that this is worth doing a little more carefully. So, what was the basic picture that this general alignment tried to push forward? And the basic picture is that you've got some sort of rotational averaging in the problem. That the kick, or the thrust, that's given to the star is long-lived, and you average off all the transverse component, or most of the transverse component, leaving you behind with only the component along the spin axis. This is really nicely discussed in a very influential paper by Spreet and Finney in 98, and then there's been some more recent work on this problem. Clearly, though, if you're going to take this seriously, you need more examples and better measurements. So what do we need to make this into a real test? Well, you need the full vectors. So you need, first of all, the amplitude of the angular momentum vector, the amplitude, the initial spin period. And that's only known for a handful of pulsars. Here's a recent compilation that Vicky Caspi and her colleagues did. That's less than a dozen objects for which we have, from spin kinematics, reliable measurements of the initial spin. There are other constraints, as Roger can say, from energetics of the PWN and such, but it's a tough game. There's not many objects to work with. How about the spin direction? Well, we're going to assume that the present direction tells us what we need to know, and as I've discussed, you can get the direction in full 3D, if you believe it, from the jets and tori structure, and at least in 2D from the polarization, at least in the plane of the sky. Motion. Well, a lot of progress on proper motion in some cases, and then, as I mentioned, occasionally you have to retreat to just use the offset from the burst site. So, proper motion. Well, Crabb is so important in this game that we thought it was very important to take a look at it again. And if I, let's see, go back. There's the actual, we went back and went through the HST images and included the observations from the, back is good, forward was tough. And we went back and reprocessed the HST images and did a very careful measurement, and we found something pretty interesting. The angle is really not quite what has been claimed in some of these original papers. In fact, we weren't able to reproduce those results at all. I don't see how they got any significant measurement. But in any case, going through the observations over about a 4 times longer time base, this is the final result we get. It's about 26 plus or minus 3 degrees off of the axis of symmetry. So there's the birth location of the Crabb pulsar, according to this calculation. And this is using, fairly careful treatment of the distortions in the HST images. I understand that Kaplan and Anderson are having another go at this, and I think they should be able to do even better. I believe this should be able to knock down to a 1 degree uncertainty. So Crabb's in pretty good shape. We really know what it's doing. How about some of the other guys? Well, some are less definitive. For example, there's that object that I showed you where we had those nice long narrow jets. That's PSR 1706-44, and it's associated with this supernova remnant, possibly. Well, I mean, you can even draw a sort of center of this thing. If it's associated, there's your velocity. But when you look right down at it, the jet axis, and it's a very clear axis of symmetry in the problem, is quite a few degrees off. Personally, I am a little skeptical about this association. The velocity required from the center is quite high, and in fact, it's contradicted by ISS measurements on the 1D velocity, and it doesn't really agree with the overall scale of the bubble in the jet around this source. There's other cases where you have really nice tori or jets and you can't do much with it. 3C58's a toughie. beautiful little torus and a little jet system in the center. You can do an offset from the center of radial expansion, which is fairly, really quite well measured. We did that, and you get 840 kilometers a second. Yeah, it's high. Maybe not unbelievable, but it's certainly quite high. Here's an example where you know the velocity very well. 1951 in CTB 80, there's a beautiful kinematic measurement of this proper motion, and it points right back to the center of the CTB 80 bubble. But where's the spin axis? Well, this guy is actually a bow shock, and if you look carefully at the Chandra and the deep radio images, you don't see much. But in the HST image, at least, well, there's this axis of symmetry on the H-alpha jets that come off of it, and that axis of symmetry can be compared with the proper motion. Finally, I want to mention this guy. I think this is perhaps the most interesting pulsar in the set. I'm not going to go through all of them because the talk's kind of short. This guy is one that we started working on a few years ago, and it's really kind of fun because it's in this supernova remnant S147. The remnant's not all that old. It's probably only about 30,000 years old. The pulsar has a spin-down age of 6 times 10 to the 5th. So it clearly was born at very nearly its present period. So its birth period is 140 milliseconds, a very slow rotator. You can get its offset from the center of the remnant, but in fact, that velocity, we don't even need to do that now. We have a brilliant parallax and proper motion, actually, from VLBA work. And with very high precision, we now know its direction of motion. So here's one of those initial 20 kilosecond Chandra images. And there's some sort of axis of symmetry in the problem here. I wanted to show you, we just got a new 100 kilosecond image last week from Chandra. And indeed, it does show the same axis of symmetry. But unfortunately, it's probably a little premature to put it up and show it to you. They're rather like photons. So the contours is when you actually do you're just smoothing the heck out of it. Now, that you shouldn't take too seriously. What you've got to do in this job is actually take a model and then just it's a parameterized model, and you put constraints on the parameters. The ones that you probably shouldn't believe, the only one that you really should believe, I think, in this case, is the axis of symmetry. Actually, in this case, it's the only thing you care about. Now, six is maybe a little overkill. I mean, of course, you have to do a detailed model of the PSF. There's about 40 photons in that data set. That's only 20 kiloseconds. The name of the game to play this job is several hundred kiloseconds nowadays. So it's a very tough business. I don't expect that very many of these will be measured. After the Crab and Vela, which were easy, it's hard work. And it's going to be tough to get the job done. OK, just a few words about the dynamics of the collapse. So you've got this energy, and you're going to be dumping it in some form. We're going to use, as a proxy for the total energy release, we're going to be just using the gravitational potential energy, and the time scale that we're going to be interested in here is basically the cooling time of the proto-neutron star. As it cools, of course, it shrinks. So the spin evolves. The spin, as it spins up, the characteristic time scale of the averaging, of course, decreases. So you're dumping momentum, linear and perhaps angular. And at the same time, the central object, which you're imparting that momentum to, must be spinning up. Of course, there may be periods of oscillating spin up and spin down, but on this time scale of seconds that we're mostly going to be interested in, we should be looking at the final cooling phase of the star. So the angular momentum averaging improves as it cools. Onward, forward. Okay, so here's some calculations, some simple simulations. And one of the basic points I think is obvious here. If you start with a relatively large equivalent period, of course, when you wallop this thing, it gets a large perpendicular momentum, and then it only starts averaging out over long timescales. So you tend to end up with a pulsar that has a large misalignment, a large perpendicular velocity, small parallel velocity. Short period pulsars, here's something that's equivalent period after cooling of 15 milliseconds, and you end up getting something that's quite highly aligned. No big surprise. That's been discussed for quite a while. Here are the data, such as they are. The guys in solid lines are the ones where you can really make a measurement of the axis, and you have a serious measurement of the proper motion, and you know something about the initial spin period. There's a few others which you don't have those measurements yet, and then these guys where you're forced to rely on the offset from the center of the supernova remnant. I find them highly unsatisfactory in general. But here's the prediction that that Spreet and Finney and others have talked about. Simple rotational averaging. If you ask me, it doesn't look very good. In fact, you might say, look at this mess. How can we get anything out of it? But there's hope, because there is more physics to this problem. Because in addition to just the line of sight, line of centers kick, you can have an off-axis kick doing pretty well, and there can be a torque. So this is, I guess, the excuse for the title. A punted football, when you kick it correctly, it has a spin. And of course, that is what provides its stability. And English, on a cue ball, if you prefer your sports to be indoors, you had a spin off by kicking it off the center of the axis. So these sort of spin-induced kicks are probably the name of the game. So let's look at some simulations that we did, where we take our neutron star and follow it through the cooling, and we've used a variety of neutrino cooling things that have been models that have been published in the literature. It doesn't seem to matter too much. The idea is you have a characteristic time scale for the thrust of this momentum. So here's the basic behavior. If you have a kick on axis, so the angle to the line of centers is zero, then the basic behavior expected is easily shown. And in fact, the angle basically corresponds, correlates with the initial spin period. Aligned pulsars also tend to have large velocity in this model. However, if you allow there to be a significant off-axis component, i.e. the kick has an angle to the normal, things are really quite different. So there's this prediction, Spreet and Finney, as we'll see, it doesn't really get borne out, but the simple omega-v correlations really get highly washed out. So here's omega for the neutron star, a little blurry, it'll come out better. And then the angle between the spin and the proper motion axes. And what you find is quite interesting. Sure, there's some residual correlation. The really fast spinning pulsars do average things out. But in this intermediate period of 30 to 60 milliseconds, you can expect very large misalignments. This isn't too deep. If you kick something hard from the side, but it doesn't spin fast enough to get many rotations during the time scale of that kick, it's like a sideways thrust, like a sideways impulse. Kick will be orthogonal to spin. It's the sort of thing that I would expect in the simulations that we saw this morning. So let's go ahead and try to see what we can get from the data set such as it is. What do we use? The handful of pulsars for which we have a full vector measurement of these properties. Of course, we have more pulsars for which we have a direction of the angular momentum, even though we don't know its initial amplitude, and a direction of the motion. And there's quite a few objects for which we have simply the velocity. So you've got this three-dimensional data space, two vector quantities plus the angle between them. And you know, you get pulsars, and the pulsars have a certain uncertainty in each of these quantities. And sometimes you have things like the velocity distribution where you simply know a projection onto one plane of this data cube. So here's the actual fitting procedure and the fitting parameters. Each of these are distributions. We fit for four quantities. Eta, the fraction of the initial energy that's going into this energy momentum of the kick. A characteristic time scale for the kick to turn on. You can think of it as just a turn-on gate, an exponential turn-on gate on the light curve. It gives you a time scale for the momentum be deposited, the angle to the normal, and then finally an initial spin period, which has some distribution. And so I'll show you four panels of each of the three projections of that cube just to give you an idea of what's going on with some of the data points plotted over it. So this is no delay, radial kick, finite delay, radial kick, kick with some spin inducement, no delay, kick with spin induced and delay. And these are just for a particular eta and a particular set of parameters. So the first panel was period and angle. This panel is omega, rather, and velocity. And by the way, this sort of predicted correlation that the stronger you kick it, the faster it goes and the faster it spins just isn't borne out. The residual averaging really strongly affects the results when you have a finite duration kick of this sort. And finally, I think this one's pretty interesting. 3D velocity and then the angle between the kick and the spin. All right, here's you can see the data. The blue objects are not fit in this model because these are objects for which we had to rely on the offset from the initial supernova remnant. And here's the parameters. So what do you learn from this? Well, first of all, the fraction of the total energy that's involved in this is not too surprisingly, it's a few percent. And this gives us a nice velocity tail that goes out over 1,000 kilometers a second. So that's pretty good. The initial spin period is not strongly constrained, but it seems to prefer relatively short initial spin periods. By the way, if you put out the final period distribution and inject it ab initio initially, it still requires that you have substantial off-axis kicks. Here, 0.7 in radians. They're really quite large, not tangential, but about 30 to 40 degrees. And it's strongly excluded that you have purely radial kicks. Finally, time scale. The characteristic time scale in this problem seems to be a few seconds. So this might accord rather well with the sort of simulations of the later time oscillations that we saw this morning. That last oscillation, which is on a time scale of seconds, could indeed be the oscillation which freezes in the final kick and final spin. So I conclude with a few speculations. So if you adopt this interpretation, the fit quite strongly tells you that you seem to have a fairly large sigma. And that sigma seems to be, you know, it's a fixed pattern speed at the surface, that there's some way of averaging away some of that momentum. The initial spin periods of the pulsars, well, you can read them. It seems to me that these hydrodynamic models, which are, it's very intriguing to see angular momentum finally being followed there. It's going to be very exciting to see how they develop over the next few years. Magnetic field-induced neutrino anisotropies, they're very appealing, but I think anything that pushes us to 10 to the 15 and a half or 10 to the 16 Gauss needs to have stronger than circumstantial evidence to make us adopt it. But anyway, there we go. That's enough. Okay, did I start any hairs here? Let's see.
I have a comment on the link to the simulations. I think when you see the movies and when you show the movies, of course, you always are in danger that people see in the movies what they want to see.
Yeah, sure.
maybe there were too many movies. I got some comments. I think it should not be confused what you have seen with the fact that the last motion, the last wave of instability gives the kick. What you saw this morning was that there is a long phase of acceleration due to the anisotropies which get established in a number of oscillation periods. And after some while you have a pattern which is self-similarly frozen in when the explosion takes off. And when this pattern exerts a gravitational pull or there is long-lasting accretion on one side of the neutron star can be accelerated. And only that is the way to drive its velocity slowly over a timescale of seconds to these high velocities which we actually see. So it's not a last thing which happens after seconds, but it's a long process working in one direction over many seconds.
In that sense, I agree that that could also be said of the sort of things that John was showing, that there's an axis that's established fairly early on, and then the amplitude builds. But of course, the final amplitude you actually get in an oscillatory sort of behavior as this really depends on where it freezes out and where things stop. So it could, in principle, be almost anywhere in the cycle, although I agree that the characteristic amplitudes build over time. But if what you're trying to look for is the actual correlations of the final directions, it's really that last buildup to largest amplitude which freezes in the parameters that we hope to measure archaeologically. Yeah, it's just archaeology here. So, yeah. Any other questions or comments?
Well, since you mentioned binaries, I want to make a comment.
You should do. I almost stayed out of that completely.
Now, you emphasized the previous speakers as well, the large kicks often observed. Now, from studies of binaries, in particular BEXIT binaries, it's also clear, and I'm referring to the work by Eric Fahl, that some neutron stars don't get big kicks.
That's right.
And that's just as puzzling.
Well, no, actually we found it, the velocity distribution was actually surprisingly easily introduced in this sort of picture, even if you have a characteristic kick amplitude, because after all, the kick location on the surface varies a lot. And kicks that are rotationally averaged away do not give any large net linear momentum. So in that kind of long-lived kick picture, if you allow rotational averaging, with the distribution of kick amplitudes, of course, you actually do surprisingly well. It matches the velocity distribution very nicely. In these particular models, it was not bimodal velocity distribution. I would argue that the more recent studies don't seem to strongly support that picture, but, you know, the jury's still out. Ed, yeah?
Just to add to what Philip said, as Eric Fahl found, it looks like in binaries there is a bimodal distribution among the BE X-ray binaries. There is the group with the very small eccentricities and then the group with large eccentricity orbits. And I think also from the double neutron stars you find the same type of behavior, that it seems that there is a group of neutron stars that get very little kicks. And now the idea which Philip put forward is that the ones which have the, well, it is consistent with the idea that the ones who come from an oxygen neon magnesium core collapse would get a little kick, and the other ones who come from the iron core collapse could get a big kick. And would that be possible to fit that with the models which Thomas gets? And
yeah, it's entirely conceivable.
But then you would only in the binaries, because there is some reasons to expect the oxygen neon magnesium collapse only to occur in binaries, so the single ones would always get kicked.
That's an excellent point, and of course this set here is strongly prejudiced. I mean, this is the single high energy, yeah, rapid spinning neutron stars where you can make the pleurion measurement. So it is a biased subset. However, it is the subset where people claimed that there was very strong spin velocity correlation. And I guess if you're going to take one thing home, I don't think the story is as simple as people who told you that things are all aligned. I don't think that's the answer. Okay.
Roger, yeah, this is slightly off topic, but I can't resist. I mean,
You've
got the millisecond, the periods between 20 and 40 milliseconds, so They're crab-like, the initial burst. Have you thought about how this impacts the gravitational wave astronomy game in terms of the number of signals they would get from neutron stars?
No, I have not thought about that. That's my answer.
Right, it should probably drop from what they use. They assume shorter periods, I think.
If you take this as gospel, though, I think that you're a bit too much of a true believer. Go ahead, Chuck. You can speak up.
I don't think this is off topic. I know a number of your pulsars were gamma ray pulsars, kind of Vela 1706.
Funny that. And, why do you think I got into this game?
And we know that there are at least two models, and one of which is a inner gap polar cap model, where where you look at a circulating polar cap very close to the rotation axis. And if that is a correct interpretation, it implies a very high space velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And if the space velocity is too high, and also if you try to make it bigger, then you have a much larger opening angle of the jet. And so obviously all these observations bear on the viability of that model.
Yeah.
And so...
Okay, so just to fill in the rest of the group, I mean, there's sort of been two camps in the gamma ray pulsar emission game. Chuck's worked a bit on one of the models where it's coming from relatively near the surface, and I've worked quite a bit on another model where it's coming from farther out in the magnetosphere. And he's absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons that we got involved in looking at these pleurions, is that a strong determinant of this, of which model is viable, is what your inclination of the spin axis of the line of sight is. If you believe, as we do, that measurements of these toroidal structures let you measure inclination, you know where you're looking. And I would say that the ones that we see, you seem to be looking at relatively large inclination angles. Very difficult to understand in a polar cap model unless the opening angles are just extreme, much larger than most people would be comfortable with. So yes, my vote is that it tells us that it's almost certainly a relatively high altitude process. Sorry, Chuck.
No, I've been out of the game long enough, it doesn't concern me so much.
Okay. Sri, sure.
Just some nitty-gritty things. Can you go back to that list of pulsars?
For which their initial spin periods?
Yeah.
Vicky's list, by the way. It's not mine, but that's okay.
How we got the initial spin periods.
How we got them on each of them?
Yeah, let's discuss
that. Oh, lordy.
No, you're at the table. We just...
I can do it. I can get there. There.
No. Let's go to that figure because...
Oh, the figure. Yeah. You want the actual values, huh? All right.
You had a figure with...
Stop me when I passed it, then. Which one do you want? You want this one?
Yeah, right.
There you go.
Okay. Well, let's sign off on Crab.
Ha! Thanks. Okay. It's a fairly small error bar.
Yeah, let's sign off...
You sign off on this guy unless something exotic happens?
Well, I don't know about... Well, why do you... Yeah, why...
You can give me any... I'll give you any breaking index you want, and it won't change by more than half a millisecond.
No, wait. What? All you know, you're putting some age for that.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
The age comes from the proper motion from the center of the remnant. It comes from the age of the remnant. It comes from the cooling age of the neutron star. All three are about the same.
Oh, come on. Wait. This is...
Hey, that's what you do in this game.
age of the remnant, how do I get that?
You only have to get it within a factor of three or so to get this large discrepancy. Remember, we're talking about a pulsar whose characteristic age is nearly 10 to the 6 years. And Sri, if you're telling me that remnant is 10 to the 6 years old, I will think you have a striking new model for supernova, and I'd be very interested in hearing about it.
Well, I don't know. I'll put some breaking index, which makes it...
You can use whatever you want.
Okay, how about 0540 minus 69?
Ah, okay, well, that one's from the literature. Sure, that's for the measured breaking index.
Well, 1706 minus 44, 1124. I mean, none of these are historical. I mean, even 3358 is kind of dodgy. But, okay, I'll accept the fact it explored whatever 800 or 1200 AD, fine. I mean, 1509 minus 58, I think you don't even know what the remnant is. And the one
you mean
in
it's not associated with the remnant that it's in?
Well, I don't know. It's like the three
possible
things going on there.
But yeah, look, this is a complicated game. I don't mean to imply that this is a trivial thing, that you go out and make measurements, but there's only a handful which these initial spin periods have been claimed. You want to do a full vector comparison, you should use what you can. Now, in some cases, you have some ancillary supporting evidence from the energetics of the PWN, and you can use that in some cases to constrain the initial spin period. But Sri, I mean, I'm not going to claim that the detailed position of the spins...
Well, getting P0, I think the hardest part really for getting P0 is, unless you have historical age...
Well, for most of these, you will not have historical ages because they're far too old.
P and the slope there, and then you don't even know the second derivative of that, and the age is really unknown for a lot of these things.
When you have a good association with a remnant, and even with a PWN, then you can do a bit better, even if it's not historical.
Remnant ages are not known.
No.
Typically.
But in many cases, they don't need to be known to better than a factor of 2 to 3 to make these kind of statements. Now.
So you should at least put a horizontal thing, you know. Horizontal error bar.
There is a horizontal error bar here. You notice how the circle's a little boxy? I'm sorry, but for any breaking index you have, it's under half a millisecond uncertainty. So I don't know. Of course, you can always do something pathological and have it go out forever. But there you have it. His caution is wise, but it's not entirely necessary.
I have another problem with your formulae. How crucial is it that you take these? I have not followed the detailed calculation, don't know exactly where it ends up with, but you have used the formula where you calculate the neutrino luminosity with independence of a changing neutron star radius. This is completely weird. I mean,
no, we actually take neutrino cooling curves from published literature, and then you get the radius from the neutrino curves.
Yeah, if that is sensitive.
This is just gross energetics.
Okay.
It's not.
So does it sensitively enter the whole calculation?
Actually, no, because we used 3 or 4 different models of the cooling, and it's very independent of that, so I don't think it matters much.
Okay.
You just got bulk angular momentum conservation and moment of inertia change.
Fine.
That's all you want.
I'm worried about the formula, but
it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It honestly doesn't. Okay.
No more questions. So let's thank the speaker again.
I'll leave this here.
Our next speaker